Sweet potato fly. Sweet potato fly is a really wonderful traditional tonic beverage from Guyana, on the northern coast of South America. It's a big hit whenever I make it. I've made sweet potato fly using various starters, including water kefir, whey, and ginger bog. The major ingredients are sweet potatoes and sugar. For a gallon, or 4 liters, I use 2 large sweet potatoes and 2 cups, or 500 milliliters, of sugar. You may like it a little sweeter. Grate sweet potatoes into a bowl, then remove starch by covering the grated sweet potato with water, stirring and pouring off now cloudy water. Repeat until the water pours off clear. You could just cover the grated sweet potato with a gallon of water, mix in sugar to taste, and add starter to make a simple fly. Or you can dress it up a bit. I learned to make sweet potato fly incorporating lemon, eggshell, and what I call the Christmas spices, cloves, cinnamon, nutmeg, and mace. For a gallon, use 1 or 2 lemons, juice, and grated rind. The mace is cooked into water. Bring about 1 teaspoon of mace, fresh or powdered, to a boil in 2 cups of water. Then remove from the heat, cool by adding cold water, and add to the sweet potato mix. Add 1 few whole cloves and 1 pinch each of ground cinnamon and nutmeg. The eggshell seems to neutralize sourness and, as noted in the water kefir section, encourages starter growth if you are working with water kefir grains. Clean an eggshell, crush into small pieces, and add to mix. Culture sweet potato fly with whey, ginger bug, or water kefir. If you use water kefir, note that if you add the grains, it will be very difficult and tedious to separate them from the grated sweet potatoes. Either use sugar water cultured with water kefir grains rather than the grains themselves, or use cheesecloth to create a teabag-like enclosure for the water kefir grains for easy removal. Ferment the sweet potato fly for 1 or 2 days. Then, after the mix is good and bubbly, you can strain into sealable bottles. Leave sealed bottles at ambient temperatures 1 or 2 days until the bottles become pressurized, then refrigerate before they get overcarbonated and potentially explosive. Inventive soda flavors. Sweet potato fly, ginger beer, roots beer, fruit beer. Indeed, any of these tonic beverages can, when carbonated, be thought of as natural sodas. There is no flavor that cannot be made into a carbonated beverage. The basic formula is sweetened water, with sugar, honey, agave, maple, sorghum, fruit juice, or any carbohydrate sweetener, plus flavoring, fruit, herbs, essential oil, plus culture, fermented for 1 short time, then sealed in 1 bottle and fermented for 1 little more time until pressure builds, indicating carbonation. Here are 1 few flavors people who have written to me raved about. Carrot juice fermented with ginger. It was just about the most delicious drink I've ever had, writes Mike Choll of Philadelphia. Ginger, cinnamon, clove, nutmeg, and molasses fermented with water kefir make a lovely gingerbread-flavored soda-like thing, writes Bev Hall of Hillsboro, Tennessee. Pine needle. When Erin Newell woofed in Japan, she stayed on a farm where a pine cider called Mitsuya was served every day. It's made by stuffing a jar full of pine needles and then topping it up with sugar water. Add a starter to this infusion and bottle it, and you get a pine-flavored soda. Coconut water goat kefir. I mixed some of my fermented coconut water with goat kefir and added 1 few berries and let it sit overnight, writes my friend Destin Joy Lane of Brooklyn, New York. It's fizzy and creamy and absolutely delicious. Three Stone Hearth. A community-supported kitchen in Berkeley, California, makes natural sodas in many unusual flavors, including antique rose and 7 different hibiscus combinations. Honeysuckle, blueberry lemon verbena, lemon rosemary, and strawberry rose geranium are favorite fermented herbal soda flavors of April McGregor, who ferments vegetables commercially in Carrboro, North Carolina, and still experiments for fun. Experiment, invent, go wild. Just beware the dangers of overcarbonation. Nishanga's soda flavors. Nishanga Bliss is an acupuncturist and nutritionist in the San Francisco Bay Area who authored the book Real Food All Year, New Harbinger, 2012. Nishanga has also been teaching classes in fermenting natural sodas, and she sent me this list of some of her favorite flavors. Hibiscus and Schizandra, with and without rosehip. Goji berry and rosehip. Elderberry, goji berry, and hibiscus. Strawberry and scarlet queen turnip. Lemon and rosemary. blackberry and hibiscus. And a client has made her own, by prescription from me for heartburn symptoms, fresh calendula flower and bee pollen. Nishanga says I usually use evaporated cane juice or honey for the sweetener. For starters, I've been using yogurt whey, water kefir grains, encapsulated probiotics, and most recently, ginger turmeric bug. Adding fresh grated turmeric root to ginger bug gives it a lot more bubble power, sometimes too much, but if you use half the amount of ginger in the bug, it doesn't alter the flavor much. Smrika. Smrika is a wonderful light juniper berry soft drink from Bosnia that I learned about from Luke Regalbuto and Maggie Levenger, who traveled around Eastern Europe seeking hands-on education with traditional fermentation methods, and now sell fermented foods and beverages in the San Francisco Bay Area as Wild West Ferments. Luke and Maggie encountered Smrika at a particular establishment they happened into in Sarajevo. Smrika did not seem to be widely consumed around Bosnia, they wrote to me. They believe the place where they had it was Muslim-owned because the smrika was served in lieu of any sort of alcohol. The smrika they were served was cold out of the fridge with a heaping spoonful of sugar. I enjoy mine unsweetened at room temperature and with some carbonation from being sealed in a bottle. When we inquired about the beverage and its contents, they just kept saying smrika, which means juniper berry, as if that was the only ingredient, which seemed preposterous to us, as it tasted so dynamic and delicious, and there appeared to be something else in there, white stuff at top of bottle, but indeed it is just the juniper and some sort of yeast, wild, of course. Smrika could not be easier to make. All you do is add juniper berries to water in a jug or jar, no sugar at all. I have picked juniper berries in the western United States and used them in sauerkraut. I've made smrika with dried juniper berries I bought from a bulk herb supplier, and it worked fine. Most junipers, including the common Juniperus communis, produce berries that are tasty and safe to use. A few species, notably the Eurasian J. sabina, produce berries that are regarded as toxic. If you harvest juniper berries from a new place, taste one before you harvest a bunch, and spit it out if the taste is harshly bitter. Only use berries with a mild, pleasant flavor. I use 2 cups, 0.5 liter, of berries for 1 gallon, 4 liters, of water. Cover with a cloth or cap loosely to allow pressure to release. Alternatively, cap tightly and relieve the pressure every few days, yielding a carbonated beverage. Leave this to ferment about a month, less in hot weather. The berries float to the top, slowly infusing color and flavor into the water and beginning to bubble. Shake or stir a couple of times a week. Within about a week, the smrika develops a lovely light flavor. As a few weeks pass, the fermenting action builds in vigor. When all the berries have sunk to the bottom, the smrika is ready, according to Luke and Maggie, though I typically start enjoying mine sooner and then give them a second go-round of water, less this time, to just cover the berries. Noni. Noni is the fruit of the tropical tree of the same name. Latin name, Morinda citrifolia, native to Southeast Asia. It is believed to have traveled to Hawaii with the earliest Polynesian settlers. Ripe noni has an intensely cheesy flavor. Throughout its range, noni is used medicinally and as a dye. As a food in Hawaii and elsewhere, noni fruits were primarily famine food, otherwise fed to pigs. In other places, they were more commonly eaten. The Latin name Morinda is derived from morus, Latin for mulberry, and indeed the fruit roughly resembles a mulberry in shape. In Hawaii, where I have encountered noni, it is frequently used medicinally. Traditionally, Hawaiians used medicinal noni primarily topically, not internally, and considered the plant to have cleansing properties of the blood, intestines, and other body systems, according to an anthropological account. I developed a staph infection when I visited Hawaii and used a topical poultice of noni to successfully treat it. In contemporary Hawaii, fermenting a noni beverage has become a widespread household practice, although whether or not it is traditional is a matter of some dispute. At present, the most popular traditional means of preparing noni in Hawaii is fermentation, report a team of ethnobotanists. Typically, the fruit is sealed in a large glass jar, which is left out in the sun for hours, days, or weeks. Noni fruits are hard and white when first picked, but rapidly transform into translucent fruits dripping with juice. This signifies that fermentation has begun. To do this yourself, simply place fruits into a jar. Seal the vessel to limit air circulation, but do release pressure occasionally. Gradually, the vessel will contain more juice and less solid remnants of the fruits. The juice appearance is initially an amber or golden-colored liquid that gradually darkens with age, according to University of Hawaii's Noni website. Noni juice is produced under a wide range of temperature and light conditions in Hawaii. For example, many backyard noni juicers place a large glass jar with noni fruits out in the direct sun for many months before consuming the juice. Fermentation time varies from days to months. Fermented juice is drained from solids and enjoyed as a sour tonic. The presence of fermenting vessels on countless lanai, porches, and rooftops across neighborhoods island-wide is taken as an affirmation of noni's efficacy, at the same time that it evokes a sense of community, a key element in the success of complementary medicines. Kombucha, panacea or peril? Kombucha is sugar-sweetened tea fermented by a community of organisms into a delicious sour tonic beverage, sometimes compared to sparkling apple cider. Kombucha is typically produced by a SCOBY, also known as a mother, that takes the form of a rubbery disc which floats on the surface of the tea as it ferments. The community of organisms can also be transferred via the kombucha liquid itself, which can generate a new SCOBY. The kombucha mother closely resembles a vinegar-making byproduct, mother of vinegar, and is composed of many of the same organisms. Indeed, some analysts have come to the conclusion that they are exactly the same. No other ferment even approaches kombucha in terms of its sudden, dramatic popularity, at least in the United States. Kombucha has enjoyed acclaim in many varied locales, widely promoted as beneficial to health, notably in Central and Eastern Europe over the course of the last century. And its use has been growing in the United States since at least the mid-1990s. I first tried kombucha around 1994, when a friend of mine with AIDS started making and drinking it as a health practice. It was touted as a general immune stimulant, though claims of kombucha's benefits have been extraordinarily varied and broad. In those days, kombucha was not commercially available in the United States, but it spread exclusively through grassroots channels as enthusiasts grew more and more mothers and sought to share them. Today, there are dozens of commercial enterprises manufacturing and selling kombucha, ranging from small startups to multinational corporations. In 2009, a leading U.S. brand, GT's Kombucha, sold more than 1 million bottles, and Newsweek reports that between 2008 and 2009, U.S. kombucha sales quadrupled from $80 million to $324 million. Kombucha has inspired much polarized debate, with claims of dramatic curative properties matched by dire warnings of potential dangers. My own conclusion is that both sets of claims tend to be exaggerated. Kombucha is neither panacea nor peril. Like any ferment, it contains unique metabolic byproducts and living bacterial cultures that may or may not agree with you. Try some, starting with small servings, and see how it tastes and feels to you. Many enthusiasts regard kombucha as something of a miracle cure-all. Harold W. Tietze, an Australian promoter of kombucha, writes that he has received reports of kombucha being used to effectively treat disorders including arthritis, asthma, bladder stones, bronchitis, cancers, chronic fatigue syndrome, constipation, diabetes, diarrhea, edema, gout, hay fever, heartburn, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, kidney problems, multiple sclerosis, psoriasis, prostate disorders, rheumatism, sleeping disorders, and stomach and bowel disorders. Herbalist Christopher Hobbs recorded the following additional claims from discussions on an internet bulletin board. Kombucha is said to cure AIDS, eliminate wrinkles and remove liver spots, reduce hot flashes during menopause, and help muscle aches, joint pains, coughs, allergies, migraine headaches, and cataracts. While people suffering from each of these conditions may indeed feel that their conditions improved by drinking kombucha, there is no scientific data to back up any of these claims, writes Hobbs. We cannot expect foods to be panaceas. One common explanation for the healing power of kombucha is that it contains glucuronic acid, a compound produced in our livers, which binds with various toxins for elimination. Günter Frank, a German promoter of kombucha's health benefits, explains, "Kombucha does not target a specific body organ, but, rather, influences the entire organism positively by the detoxifying effect of its glucuronic acid." Unfortunately, repeated laboratory analysis has found that glucuronic acid is not actually present in kombucha. Possibly it has been confused with a related compound that is a metabolic byproduct of glucose, gluconic acid, which is commonly found in ferments and other foods. In 1995, a small group of kombucha enthusiasts began investigating kombucha chemistry through laboratory testing. One of them, Michael R. Rowson, explains, "Conflicting reports of the ferment's contents, along with a warning from the FDA, prompted me to take a closer look at what I was drinking. After performing mass spectral analysis, specifically looking for glucuronic acid, on 887 different samples of kombucha, the group concluded that the compound was not present." As for kombucha's potential danger, in 1995, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, CDC, publication Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report ran a story headlined, "Unexplained Severe Illness Possibly Associated with Consumption of Kombucha Tea," with "possibly" being the operative word. In two separate incidents, weeks apart, two women in Iowa had very different unexplained acute health episodes. One of them died. Both drank kombucha daily and made it from the same original SCOBY. The Iowa Department of Public Health immediately issued a warning to stop drinking kombucha until the role of the tea in the two cases of illness has been evaluated fully. But they were never able to explain how kombucha may have been related to the illnesses, and 115 other people were identified who drank kombucha from the same mother without problems. When the mothers and the kombucha that possibly made the women sick were subjected to microbial analysis, no known human pathogens or toxin-producing organisms were identified. Other medical reports have associated extremely varied symptoms with kombucha consumption, also without identifying any specific toxicity or causative factor. Responding to a flurry of questions following the CDC report, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, issued a warning of sorts, cautioning that the acidity of kombucha could potentially leach lead or other toxins from vessels, and that home-brewed versions of this tea manufactured under non-sterile conditions may be prone to microbiological contamination. However, like other investigations, FDA microbial analysis found no evidence of contamination. Concern about kombucha's safety has not been limited to government regulators. Mycologist Paul Stamets published an article in 1995 called "My Adventures with the Blob." Because kombucha was mistakenly referred to as a mushroom, Stamets received frequent questions about it. As an expert in propagating and investigating isolated fungal species, a largely uninvestigated mixed culture worried him. "I personally believe it is morally reprehensible to pass on this colony to sick or healthy friends when, to date, so little is known about its proper use," he writes. Making kombucha under non-sterile conditions becomes, in a sense, a biological form of Russian roulette. While I have tremendous respect for Stamets' work with fungi, I reject the notion that making kombucha at home is random or dangerous. All of the ferments, kombucha included, involve creating selective environments to ensure success. The idea that kombucha, or any ferment, is safe only in the hands of technical experts denies the long lineages of home and village production that spawn them, and plays right into the disempowering cult of specialization. Make sure you understand the parameters of the selective environment you need to create, and you are not playing Russian roulette. Basic information and awareness are important. Empowered with them, you may ferment without fear. Making kombucha. Kombucha is usually just sugar-sweetened tea fermented by a specific community of bacteria and yeasts. Increasingly, creative kombucha makers have been giving kombucha exciting new twists by adding herb, fruit, or vegetable flavors. Typically, these flavorings are added to kombucha for a secondary fermentation following a primary fermentation of just tea and sugar. By tea, I mean an infusion made from the tea plant Camellia sinensis, not the infusions of other plants, such as chamomile or mint, that in the English language we also describe as teas. You may use black tea, green tea, white tea, kukicha, puer, or other styles of tea, but in general stay away from Earl Grey or other heavily flavored or scented teas, as the added essential oils may inhibit fermentation. You may use tea bags or loose tea, and brew the tea strong or weak as you like. I typically brew a very strong concentrate, then dilute and cool it by adding water, so I can add the SCOBY without having to wait for the tea to cool. To sweeten the tea, add sugar, meaning sucrose from sugarcane or sugar beets. Some people have reported excellent results making kombucha using honey, agave, maple syrup, barley malt, fruit juice, and other sweeteners. Others have had their SCOBYs shrivel up and die. Similarly, some people report excellent results without any tea whatsoever, using herbal infusions or fruit juices as the sole flavorings. This leads me to the conclusion that there are divergences on the kombucha family tree. Just as some people, animals, and plants can adapt better than others to altered conditions, some kombucha mothers exhibit greater flexibility and resilience than others. I would encourage you to experiment with different sweeteners and flavorings if you like, but don't use your only mother. Use one layer of the SCOBY to experiment, while maintaining the other in the traditional sugar and tea medium. Try for a few generations to make sure the mother grows and continues to thrive. The amount of sweetener may vary with your taste. Personally, I never measure the sugar, simply adding to taste. Try about 1/2 cup, 125 milliliters, by weight 4 ounces or 113 grams, of sugar per quart or liter. Stir well to dissolve. This is easiest if the sugar is added to the tea while still hot. Taste and adjust the sweetness as desired. Cool the sweetened tea to below body temperature. As described earlier, making a tea concentrate and diluting it with cold water is a fast way to do this. Place sweetened tea into a wide-mouth fermentation vessel, ideally glass or ceramic, with a non-lead glaze. Avoid metal vessels, even stainless steel, which may corrode in the prolonged presence of acids. Because kombucha is an aerobic process in which fermentation occurs on the surface where oxygen is available, it is best to use a wide vessel only partially full, so as to maximize surface area in relation to volume. To the cooled sweetened tea, add some mature kombucha at a ratio of about 5 to 10% of the volume of the sweet tea. This both acidifies the tea and contributes kombucha organisms. Acidification is important for maintaining a selective environment that favors the kombucha organisms and prevents potential contaminants from developing. If for some reason you do not have any mature kombucha to use as an acidifier, use vinegar of any kind, but in a much smaller proportion, about 2 tablespoons or 30 milliliters per quart or liter. Once you have combined cooled tea, sugar, and mature kombucha in the fermentation vessel, add the mother. Ideally, the mother will float at the surface. Sometimes it will sink at first, then slowly float back up. Other times, one edge of it will float to the surface and generate a new film over the surface. If your SCOBY fails to float or generate a new film after a few days, it is no longer viable. If your SCOBY is a different size or shape from the surface of the kombucha in your vessel, it will generate a new film that is exactly the size and shape of the surface. Always cover the vessel with a light porous cloth that allows air circulation while keeping flies and mold spores off the kombucha. Leave the vessel to ferment in a warm spot away from direct sunlight. You can purchase a mother or obtain one from another home kombucha maker via online trading posts, or grow one from commercially available live culture kombucha. To grow one, simply pour a bottle of kombucha, preferably plain without any particular flavoring, into a wide-mouth jar, cover with a cloth, and wait about a week, longer in cool temperatures, for a skin to form on the surface. This skin is a kombucha SCOBY. Kombucha symbiosis. Molly Aggie Joyce, River Falls, Minnesota. I have been nurturing cuts of the same mother in my kombucha farm for nearly 4 years and find it to be a rewarding, symbiotic relationship. I harvest something she makes by just existing, and it provides me with nutrition and a sense of connection to even the smallest life in my surroundings. In each new place I inhabit, she integrates me from the molecular level outward. I share pieces of her with friends and acquaintances, which brings me closer to other humans. As you make more kombucha with your SCOBY, it will get thicker, generally growing in layers that you can peel off and use to start additional batches of kombucha or share. I've seen kombucha mothers as thick as about 6 inches or 15 centimeters. There is no particular benefit to a huge SCOBY, so most people peel away layers and share them. Other uses I have seen or heard of for extra SCOBYs include these. Blend them into a paste and use them for facials, spreading the paste on your face and leaving it to dry there. Brooke Gillen of Nashville, Tennessee, folds thin layers of kombucha SCOBYs into flower shapes and dries them in that shape. Gorgeous. Suzanne Lee of the School of Fashion and Textiles in London makes garments out of kombucha. According to a news report, as the sheets dry out, overlapping edges felt together to become fused seams. When all moisture has evaporated, the fibers develop a tight-knit, papyrus-like surface that can be bleached or stained with fruit and vegetable dyes such as turmeric, indigo, and beetroot. Several people have reported stretching kombucha scobies and vinegar mothers onto frames and painting on them. They are composed of a cellulose, just like paper. Nata. In the Philippines, people grow a thick scoby, like the kombucha scoby, on coconut water or pineapple juice mixed with sugar water, and then cook it into a candy. You can similarly transform a kombucha scoby into candy. Kombucha does best in a warm environment, from 75 degrees to 85 degrees Fahrenheit, or 24 degrees to 30 degrees Celsius. The length of fermentation will vary depending upon specific temperature and how acidic you like it. In warm weather, I typically ferment my kombucha about 10 days. Taste it every few days and evaluate whether you want it to continue to ferment and acidify. In a cool space, say 60 degrees Fahrenheit or 16 degrees Celsius, it takes a very long time. Sometimes in winter, I have left mine for months before it acidified to my liking. Once kombucha has become as acidic as you like, only you can be the judge of that, remove the scoby, transfer the kombucha to bottles, reserving some to acidify the new batch, and brew more sweet tea to begin the process anew. Kombucha works best as an ongoing rhythm, because to remain alive, the scoby needs continual nourishment. If you go away, you can simply leave the scoby in kombucha for as long as several months, and then resume feeding it fresh sweetened tea upon your return. When your kombucha is pleasingly acidified, you have several options. The simplest is to drink it. Bottle it as is and refrigerate. If you wish to further flavor, you can add fruit or vegetable juice, or a sweetened herbal infusion or decoction, for a secondary fermentation. The most exciting kombuchas I've tried have been made in this fashion. When I visited my friends at the Cultured Pickle Shop in Berkeley for a veritable tasting orgy, I was blown away by their incredible, innovative kombucha flavors. Buddha's hand, a citrus fruit, mint and bee pollen, turnip, oh so good, and beet. They do the primary fermentation with green tea and sugar with the kombucha mother, then decant kombucha and mix with fruit or vegetable juice for a secondary fermentation. And finally, mix with a bit of honey at bottling for carbonation. The secondary fermentation may be aerobic in an open, wide-mouth vessel like the primary fermentation, or in a sealed or airlocked vessel. In an open vessel, the sweetened kombucha will likely develop a new mother on the surface, and growth will continue to be dominated by acetic acid organisms. In a sealed vessel, which could be the final bottle for serving or not, the secondary ferment will yield more alcohol as well as lactic acid. Even if you don't care to incorporate additional ingredients in a secondary fermentation, you can carbonate kombucha in bottles. Simply decant it into sealable bottles while it is still a bit on the sweet side, seal the bottles, and allow it to continue to ferment in the sealed bottles for a few more days so carbonation can develop. Add a bit of fresh sweetener at bottling to speed or increase carbonation. But beware of excessive carbonation. I can't caution listeners enough on this subject. Questions continually arise as to whether sugar and caffeine persist in mature kombucha. The sugars do metabolize into acids, so you could ferment kombucha to the point that there is no sugar left. However, at that point, your kombucha would taste like vinegar, and most people prefer it when it is still somewhat sweet, and hence still with some of the sugar intact. As for caffeine, when herbalist Christopher Hobbs submitted a sample of kombucha to a laboratory for analysis, it was found to contain 3.42 milligrams, or 100 milliliters, much less than is typically found in a cup of tea, but most definitely present. Michael Rowson reports that according to his laboratory analyses, caffeine levels remain constant throughout the kombucha fermentation period. Specific caffeine levels will vary with type and amount of tea, length of steeping, and so forth. The notion that kombucha removes caffeine from tea is unsubstantiated. If you wish to avoid caffeine, make kombucha using weak or decaffeinated tea. Another issue that has come up in relation to kombucha is its alcohol content. Kombucha probably always contains small traces of alcohol, as do nearly all fermented foods, including sauerkraut. Typically, the alcohol content of kombucha is somewhere below 0.5% by volume, which is considered a non-alcoholic beverage by law. Traces of alcohol below 0.5% are typically found in fruit juices, sodas, non-alcoholic beers, and even breads and bread products. Sometimes, however, especially with anaerobic in-bottle secondary fermentation, kombucha's alcohol content can rise above the 0.5% legal limit. In June 2010, the U.S. Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau, TTB, tested off-the-shelf samples of various commercial kombucha products and found that, in some, alcohol levels exceeded the allowed 0.5%. TTB issued a guidance document declaring that kombucha products containing at least 0.5% alcohol by volume are alcohol beverages. Many retailers removed kombucha from their shelves until greater product control could be assured. Some manufacturers are taking measures to limit opportunities for in-bottle fermentation. Others are switching from traditional kombucha to laboratory-derived defined starter cultures. Finally, a word of caution about molds that sometimes develop on kombucha SCOBYs. I have experienced mold developing on kombucha, and I simply removed the SCOBY from the kombucha, scraped or peeled the mold away, rinsed the SCOBY, and proceeded to drink the kombucha and reuse the SCOBY without incident. However, after reading Paul Stamets' article on kombucha, I would advise greater caution. Of most concern are the species of Aspergillus I have found floating around with kombucha, Stamets writes. In contrast with Aspergillus oryzae and A. soji, used for millennia to make rice beer, miso, soy sauce, and many other ferments, some Aspergillus species produce toxins. I fear that amateurs could think that by merely pulling out the Aspergillus colonies with a fork, that the culture would be decontaminated, a dangerous, even deadly presupposition. The water-soluble toxins of Aspergillus can be highly carcinogenic. Avoid molds by remembering to acidify each batch of kombucha with mature, acidified kombucha from the previous batch. In the absence of mature kombucha, you can use some vinegar. If mold should form, however, discard the batch of kombucha as well as the SCOBY and begin anew with a new SCOBY. Kombucha candy, nata. Nata is a candy made in the Philippines from the thick layer of cellulose that develops on the surface during vinegar fermentation of coconut water, nata de coco, or pineapple juice infusion, nata de pina. I've used the nata method with a kombucha mother, and the result was a sweet, squishy candy, barely sour with a hint of tea flavor, which almost everyone who tried it, kids included, liked. The process is extremely simple. A jun mother, or mother of vinegar, could be used with exactly the same process. Take a kombucha mother, at least 1/2 inch or 1 centimeter thick, rinse it and cut it with a sharp knife into small, bite-sized pieces. Soak the kombucha pieces in cold water for 10 minutes. Drain, rinse, and soak again. Then transfer the kombucha pieces to a pot, cover with water, and boil for 10 minutes. Drain, rinse, and boil again for 10 more minutes. The reason for the repeated soaking and boiling is to remove as much acidity as possible from the kombucha mother. You may find that you prefer it more acidic with fewer rinses and boilings. My friend Billy tried it after tasting mine and omitted the rinsing and boiling altogether. He preferred the flavor with the acidity intact. It reminded him of apple pie. "It's my new favorite way to enjoy the kombucha," he announced. "It's better than drinking it." The nata method of candying the kombucha pieces is to cover them with sugar, roughly as much sugar as kombucha cubes. Then heat this mixture and boil the kombucha pieces in the syrup that forms for about 15 minutes, then remove from the heat and allow to slowly cool. After cooling, drain off any remaining syrup, crisp up in the oven for a few minutes or air dry, and enjoy kombucha candy. Billy loved it so much he invented his own method without deacidifying the kombucha and without cooking it, except at the end to dry it out. For a live culture kombucha candy, you could air dry or use a dehydrator instead. In a bowl, he alternated layers of sugar and still acidified kombucha, then poured a cooled sugar syrup, also with butter and vanilla, over them and left it marinating overnight. In the morning, he dried them, along with the extra sugar syrup, in a low oven. Finally, he sprinkled the crystallized sugar syrup on top for a caramel flavor. Jun. Jun is a culture similar to kombucha, made using honey rather than sugar, which gives it a lovely distinctive flavor. Jun also seems to mature a little faster than kombucha, and to remain active at lower temperatures. Otherwise, the process is exactly the same as kombucha, substituting honey for sugar. The lack of credible information on the history of Jun leads me to the conclusion that it is a relatively recent divergence from the kombucha family tree. Some websites claim that it comes from Tibet, where it has been made for 1,000 years. Unfortunately, books on Tibetan food, and even a specialized book on Himalayan ferments, contain no mention of it. Whether or not Jun has a 1,000-year-old history, it is quite delicious. The culture is somewhat obscure and hard to find, but its epicenter seems to be the Pacific Northwest, where the Eugene, Oregon-based Herbal Junction Elixirs produces it commercially. Vinegar. Many people have observed that the kombucha SCOBY is identical, or virtually so, to the mother of vinegar that often forms on the surface of fermenting vinegar. Some have even described kombucha as immature vinegar. Vinegar can be made from any fermented alcohol or solution of fermentable sugars. In Chapter 4, vinegar was referred to as a possible undesirable outcome in the production of alcohol. Exposure of fermenting or fermented alcoholic beverages to oxygen allows for the growth of aerobic Acetobacter bacteria, which metabolize alcohol into acetic acid, commonly known as vinegar. Wine will yield wine vinegar, cider will yield cider vinegar. Beer will yield malt vinegar. Rice-based alcohols will yield rice vinegar. If you wish to make vinegar, you do not need to have a mother of vinegar. Historically, it was believed that vinegar could not be made without this mother, explains Lawrence Diggs, who calls himself the Vinegar Man, wrote a book called Vinegar, and created a vinegar museum in Roslyn, South Dakota. We now know that it is not necessary. As long as the Acetobacter are alive in the proper solution, under the proper conditions, vinegar will be produced. Generally, because Acetobacter is so omnipresent, exposing any preservative-free fermented alcoholic beverage to air will eventually result in vinegar. But vinegar production will be faster, more efficient, and more reliable if you add some live vinegar as a starter, about one quarter the volume of fermented alcohol you're fermenting into vinegar. Understand that most commercially available vinegar is pasteurized, so the Acetobacter is no longer alive. A few brands, notably Bragg's, sell raw vinegar, and many people, going back to the Greek physician Hippocrates, consider raw vinegar to be a healthful tonic. Once you start making your own, you can simply use part of a previous batch as starter for the next. For making vinegar, use a non-metallic vessel that enables you to expose a large surface area to air. One traditional setup is a wooden barrel, on its side, less than half full. A crock, wide-mouth jar, or bowl is also perfectly adequate. Fill the vessel no more than half full in order to maximize the ratio between surface area and volume. Cover with a light cloth to keep flies out while allowing for good air circulation, and ferment in the temperature range of 59 to 94 degrees Fahrenheit, or 15 to 35 degrees Celsius, out of the path of direct sunlight. The length of time required for fermentation will vary with temperature, starter, oxygenation, and proportions, typically from 2 to 4 weeks. Once alcohol is fully converted into acetic acid, vinegar must be transferred to a sealed vessel, because if the vinegar continues to be exposed to oxygen, Acetobacter will metabolize acetic acid into water and carbon dioxide. Whereas the presence of air was crucial in the acidification process, it is now, to the same degree, undesirable, explains Diggs. The acid level will begin to fall after it has reached its peak. When it has fallen to 2% or lower, other microorganisms will now begin to take over. There are two methods for evaluating when the alcohol has been fully metabolized. The traditional method, perfectly adequate for the casual home vinegar maker, is to smell and taste it to judge whether alcohol remains. The scientific method is chemical titration, for which inexpensive kits are easily available on the internet. As soon as you determine that the alcohol has been converted into acetic acid, bottle the vinegar. If you wish to pasteurize it for greater stability, as many vinegar manufacturers do, the temperature at which Acetobacter is destroyed is 140 degrees Fahrenheit, or 60 degrees Celsius. Do not heat vinegar above 160 degrees Fahrenheit, or 71 degrees Celsius, or acetic acid will evaporate. Bottle vinegar in small, narrow-neck bottles. Fill bottles completely and tightly seal them. As extra protection against further oxidation, many vinegar makers wax the seal of the bottles. Like wine, vinegar benefits from further aging after bottling. The esters and ethers of the vinegars are allowed to mature, and many of the finer qualities emerge, writes Diggs, who recommends aging vinegar for a minimum of 6 months, ideally with chips of oak in the bottles. Although the most efficient way to make vinegar is from fully fermented alcohol, you can also make it directly from any sweet solution that could be made into alcohol. For instance, in wild fermentation, I included recipes for fruit scrap and pineapple vinegars, which call for covering fruit peels and scraps with a sugar solution. Mix the sugar solution at a proportion of roughly 1/2 cup or 125 milliliters sugar per quart or liter of water. Use a bowl or wide-mouth vessel and leave the mix to ferment open to the air, covered only with a cloth to keep flies away. It is important to stir the mix, especially in the early stages. If you do not stir frequently, not only will the process take longer, but surface molds are likely to develop. Once active bubbling is evident, strain out solid fruit residue and introduce live vinegar starter. Then proceed as described for vinegar from already fermented alcohol, although the process may take somewhat longer. Shrub. Vinegar can be the basis for sour tonic beverages. A traditional name for a vinegar-soured fruit drink is a shrub. Perusing 19th-century cookbooks, the methods vary quite a bit, but a typical recipe calls for pouring vinegar over fresh berries, raspberries are most commonly referred to, leaving overnight for flavors to infuse, then straining out the berries and cooking the fruit-infused vinegar with sugar, often as much as 1 pound of sugar per pint of vinegar, into a syrup. The cooled sweet and sour syrup may be stored, diluted with water to taste as served, and enjoyed as a soft drink. In addition to fruit, try infusing mint or other herbs into the vinegar. You can use honey or other sweeteners, and, especially if you are using raw homemade vinegar, you can omit the cooking step and simply stir to dissolve a more modest quantity of honey or sugar. For a bubbly shrub, dilute with carbonated water. Troubleshooting. Doesn't start to ferment. It may be that your starter is not viable. It may be that the solution was too hot when culture was introduced and killed it. Maybe ambient temperatures where you placed your starter are too cold. Try to find a warmer spot. Maybe chlorinated water is inhibiting fermentation. In the case of ginger bug, maybe the ginger was irradiated. Try again with organic ginger. If there was no starter other than fruit, stir, 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 and be patient. Gets too sour. This means you have fermented it too long. Try a shorter fermentation next time. Many beverages, however, notably kombucha, can be used as vinegar if they overly acidify. In addition, many overly soured beverages can be salvaged by diluting with some water or carbonated water, along with sweetener if desired. Too weak. Next time, use more of the flavoring agent, ginger, tea, sweet potato, mauvey bark, fruit, whatever, and/or sugar. Surface molds develop. Acidifying kombucha with mature kombucha or vinegar helps prevent surface molding. With ferments other than kombucha, stirring or shaking daily while they are in open vessels prevents molds by disturbing them before they become visible. In making vinegar, stir the sugary solution at least daily until a mother forms. After that, increasing acidity will help protect the vinegar from molding, and stirring becomes impossible without disturbing the mother. Kombucha mother sinks. Sometimes when you place a kombucha mother into a new batch of cooled, sweetened tea, the mother sinks to the bottom rather than floating on the surface. Be patient. Often within a few hours, the mother will float to the top. If not, sometimes one edge of the mother will float to the top, causing a new mother to be generated, which at first looks like a thin film over the surface. If neither of these things happens, and your mother remains sunken in the sweet tea, it is no longer viable as a kombucha mother. Make it into nata candy and find another mother, or culture your kombucha with a high proportion, 1/4 to 1/2, of mature kombucha, and it will generate a new mother on its surface. Straining bread for kvass is difficult. The hardest part of making kvass is squeezing out all the liquid that absorbs into the bread. Strain the bread water solution through a colander lined with a couple of layers of cheesecloth. Each time the colander fills with bread, gather the edges of the cheesecloth together, twist to wring out the liquid, and then knead the ball of cloth-encased soggy bread from different angles, trying to force out as much liquid as you can. Don't worry too much about forcing out every last bit. Water kefir grains not growing. Water kefir grains typically grow pretty rapidly. Under ideal conditions, they can more than double with each feeding. If you find that yours are not growing, it probably means that they are no longer viable. Water kefir grains can become pickled if they are left more than a few days in an acidified solution without fresh sugar. When you find some more water kefir grains, feed them more frequently to avoid this. Water kefir grains disappear. If water kefir grains are left in an acidified solution without fresh sugar, they first become pickled, then may eventually disappear.